The stage is yours.
Can you grab me his? So I also have an implant, although it's not a chip, it's a hip. So it's great coming here from Toronto. I haven't been in Sweden for a long time, the other home of Börje Salming. We own him. He played for us. So I want to talk a bit about a couple of things. So first off, if you get nothing else out of this talk, you'll learn a new word, ubiquity, and we'll come to that a bit later. But those of you who are developers, let's be clear, we love you. The same thing, all of you. But we want you to be here for a long time and not just a good time. And therefore, I want to talk to you a bit about where things are going, how we view the future, and in a way that maybe will help whether you're a developer, an IT professional, whatever, you can make better decisions going forward and seeing where the industry is going to go over the next 5 to 10 years. And so, hopefully it's not too boring of a story, but to start right off, there's an elephant in the room. And the question is, what's the elephant? Well, here's what's happening, and I see in the industry, is everybody's out there looking for the next big thing. And that's the elephant. But the trick is, it doesn't matter whether the next big thing you think it's an application, or whether you think it's a service, or whether you think it's a gadget, some piece of hardware. There is no next big thing. The next big thing is not a thing. The next big thing is actually a change in the relationship amongst the things that are already there and the things that are going to come in. And I mean that the relationships amongst the technologies, the relationships amongst the people, and very much the relationships amongst the people and the technologies. In a way, I want to take the notion of social computing away from just being something like Facebook, where social computing is about the society of technologies, the society of the technologies that are out there, superimposed with the society of people. And arguably, there's an unbelievable discrimination about technologies because they have no social relationship whatsoever. But the neat thing is, if you can view the future in terms of what's here today, that gives you a solid footing because you can understand, you can build on something you already understand. So let's take a look at what I mean by that. So here's this larger ecosystem. These are some of the technologies just in terms of the devices that Microsoft makes. So we've got right from the band up through the phone up to the Surface hubs and the HoloLens. What we need, if you couple that with the cloud, is to build a social network where all of these elements have a social relationship that connects them all, but not just connects them, but lets them communicate. And I'd argue right now that things simply don't work together. And the biggest challenge we have is facing us is because things don't work together. So back in the 80s and 90s, I worked at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, Xerox Park. And one of my colleagues was this guy, Mark Weiser, who's a really good friend. And in 1991, he wrote this paper, The Computer for the 21st Century. And in that, he introduced the term ubiquitous computing. Now, I have to tell you that when Mark started calling it ubiquitous computing, nobody knew what ubiquitous meant. I had to look it up, as did most of the other people in the labs. But the notion about ubiquitous computing is it has two properties. It's everywhere, you need it, but it's also transparent. So what does that mean? How can a technology be everywhere and be transparent? It's kind of like this. If you have your bed in the bedroom and your dining room table in the dining room, you don't notice it. If you walk in my house and you see the dining room table in the dining room, you're just going to say, it might be a nice dining room table, but just get on with your life. If I switch the two and you walk out of my house and the bed is in the dining room and the dining room table's up in the bedroom, you know something's wrong. Because there's a well-established moral order as to where things are and how they work and the space function distance relationships amongst those traditional technologies in our home. And what Mark is talking about is how this stuff relates is fundamental to getting technology really in its place. But I think he used the wrong word when he called it ubiquitous computing. He meant ubiquity, and I'll get, again, I'm gonna come back to that. But I wanna speak to it in terms of the following. I wanna talk about this place where all of us have been, which is eburbia. And to tell you about eburbia, I'm gonna have to teach you about the road net of things, which takes us to suburbia, by analogy. So here's the road net. It connects all of these houses. They're all connected. They have gateways, routers, if you will, that take you off the main network into your home. And it's a packet switching network where the packets are these cars and the data inside are the people. There's a fence all around, so there's firewalls. And in this world where everybody's connected, nobody knows their neighbor. Nobody has the keys to the next door. There's no schools, there's no playgrounds. Everything is connected and nobody communicates. And more than just connectivity, communication, there is no sense of culture. And therefore, they are, despite connectivity, there is no relationship. And that's where we are with computing. Listen, one thing I can tell you is the first thing to thinking on your own is do not believe marketing hype. Every time a new term or a new fad or new trend comes in, ask yourself, does this have any meaning to my life? And so take the Internet of Things. If there is such a thing as the Internet of Things, and it's a new thing, that says clearly, by Boolean logic in a sense, that there used to be an Internet of Unthings. There has never been anything but a thing connected to the Internet. We have always had an Internet of Things. And all we're doing in the so-called Internet of Things is adding more computationally trivial things to the same Internet. And because there is even less computation on them, that means that there's even going to be less communication amongst more and more things, and it's going to be more and more complicated to deal with it. If you walk into out a supermarket door, the door opens. It's a one-bit computer. The input device is a Kinect 0.001 called a pressure sensor or light sensor, and the display is a motor that opens the door. And that's smarter than the most powerful computer any of us own. None of our computers turn on that just because we walk in the room and open and do what we want done, without it just anticipating our needs. That's a really, really, forget, that's machine intelligence, but the intelligence of the door is by where it's located. It's at a supermarket and not the bank vault where all your money's stored. Right? We're getting towards ubiquity. Now, here's the challenge. I believe that within about 5 years, the industry risks collapsing in a way that makes the dot-com bubble look like tiny talent time. I really believe we're heading full speed to wall. And ironically, the better we do, the faster we're going to hit it and the more it's going to hurt. And it's ironic. So we have to start with people. There's this thing called the threshold of frustration, above which I just give up. You know, if everybody here has downloaded an app, you've given it a few minutes, and said, this is just too complicated, it's gone. We've had people like that as well. Okay, so as engineers, and to give them credit, the iPhone in 2007 helped drive this function down. We have become remarkably good as an industry, but also as a company. Microsoft has gotten way better, and it's something I'm really proud of us is to reduce the complexity of any application, any service, or any piece of hardware. So over time, man, the complexity of the devices is going down and the value's been going up. That is fantastic, but it's also so 2007 ago. is not enough. Because what's missing in all these wonderful, cheap, desirable, useful, you know, devices is the cumulative complexity of a bunch of simple, desirable, affordable, valuable things is still way above that threshold. And this is why the better we do at making the gadgets, the doodads, the applications, the next big things, is the faster we push that complexity curve up, no matter how simple the individual things are. And that's the thing that scares me. So what I'm saying here, the next big thing is a change in the relationship amongst the things, devices, services, and applications that are out there, and in the sense that the change in relationship is they know about each other. They share, they work, they have a family, they have a sense of kinship, they have the ability to exchange things in a trustworthy way, but in a seamless, quiet way, in all the ways you want, and none of the ways that you hardly ever, well, few of the ways you ever see today. Look at your remote controls. Ag's example. These are the real remote controls in my house. Everyone in my family, including me, knows how to work every single one of these. None of us know how to switch from the DVD player to the satellite TV because it requires three different remote controls. I've tried to explain that to my wife, except I can't even do it myself. So I would argue that if you're planning about technology, where we're going, that we follow and impose three rules upon ourselves. The first one is the obvious one. Every new product and service and device has to work. It just works. It works reliably. It brings value in terms of the customer, and it comes at an affordable cost. And hopefully it's delightful. It's got this beautiful flow. It's at least as good in today's terms as the iPhone was in 2007. If you can't do that, you shouldn't be in business. If we can't do that, we shouldn't be in business. So, but that's not enough. The next thing is, every new application, service, and device has to work with every other application, service, and device in the ecosystem. We have to look at this in terms of the ecology of the whole system. And that's something that none of us do yet. And that's the thing we have to do. But the problem is, even that's not enough. We have to go one step further because of this problem about complexity. That in working together with all the other things in the ecosystem, and by the way, when I say the ecosystem, I mean following Satya's, what he said millions of times, but the core value is there are no walled gardens. That we have to look at our customers and our partners and the people who are using our stuff in such a way that they have a choice in the market to draw technologies from. And you want to make sure that our stuff works with whatever the customer has. And if it comes from a competitor, great. Then our job is to try and make it so that the competitor's technology works better in our ecosystem than it does anywhere else. But it's an open garden. It's open. But you have to read everything you add, every new device, service, or application you get must reduce the overall complexity of all the things you already have and they it. And likewise, every single thing you add, each individual thing you add to the ecosystem must increase the value to everything else in the ecosystem and they it. And furthermore, those increases and decreases, I want to be geometric and not linear. And you could say, okay, he's lost it. And this just makes no sense. It's just not possible. So we talk a lot about machine intelligence and so on and so forth, but I just want to point out when people talk about artificial intelligence, machine learning, and machine intelligence, those are all good things, but I want to bring you back to cognitive psychology and say, the definition of intelligence from one of my heroes, the cognitive psychologist Jean Piaget, where he says, intelligence is the ability of an entity to adapt to a changing environment through the dual process of accommodation and assimilation. Intelligence is the ability to adapt to a changing environment. And so in some sense, I want to push our definition of intelligent systems up to a level, not just so it can do, you know, things like speech understanding, but where it actually can adapt into the ecosystem, not as a device and not as an individual island. And by the way, I also have this thing called the long nose theory of innovation that says it takes 20 years for any technology to evolve. It sort of comes like a hockey stick, and it hits $1 billion after about 20 years, most of it flat. And so that says that if what I'm saying is true, and this is going to happen over the next 5 years, that says I have to give you 15 years of history where what I'm talking about has already happened, but we just haven't noticed. Why? Because when ubiquitous computing is done successfully, as Mark Weiser says, it's transparent. You don't notice it any more than you notice where the plumbing is in your house or you notice where the heat comes from in this building. It just works. So, as we come along this and we go do some examples, there's a couple questions. Is there value in things working together? It's a rhetorical question, but I like this one because I like to do this with Microsoft employees, but I'll do it with you anyhow. What is the greatest financially rewarding and in terms of benefit to the customer, what is the most innovative, valuable innovation in the history of Microsoft? Shout it out. Louder. The word's the same in Swedish as it is in English. No, it's Office. Now I want you to think about this for a minute. Office was a bunch of things, not all of which even came from Microsoft, which were bundled together and sold as a package. It's a trivial level of putting things together, but doing so has been financially probably the biggest innovation in the history of the company. Notice, most people think Microsoft's a technology company. That was not a technological decision. That was a marketing decision. Your mother has the technological skills to have made that decision. Maybe not the marketing skills, but the technological skills. So are we really a technology company? No, we're an experience company. And the technology is just part of it. The marketing is just part of it. The point here is also notice, talking about open systems, that the first version of Office was released on the Macintosh, not on the PC. Again, a lot of people don't know that history. So I'm just saying it's really interesting. Some of the values I'm talking about, things working together and working in a no-walled gardens, is right in our tradition. And maybe a tradition we forgot for a while, but we haven't. But we've got our memory back. And so there's other examples here. Now, the other question I had up there was, can we make this transition over a period of time? So again, I want to use that example another. When we put Office together, the things weren't really compatible. There were different hotkey mappings from between Excel and Word. You didn't have .NET yet. You didn't have Olay or any of this copy and paste. So it took multiple iterations to get things really working, but there was a smooth evolutionary path, and you would never go back, but you have to get there. What I'm talking about today isn't saying tomorrow you got to make what I said my third rule work. But just like Office, you know where you want to go, so you can now start to plan and get there along with us. And it doesn't have to be disruptive. But let me prove to you that it already works. So I literally have the car photographed here. I mean, that's not a photograph of my car, but I have a black 2010 Ford Escape. That exact vehicle. And I also have a phone that's the same as the phone you see there. So we're going to say about that. There's my phone. I can make phone calls. It has value on its own. If my wife wants to drive my car right now in Toronto with my phone here, she can do so. Both technologies have value in and of themselves. But when I get into my car and I put my phone on the passenger seat, and I start driving, something really interesting happens. If you phone me, I can hit on the steering column one button and we can talk. If you send a text to me, the stereo gets turned down, and this woman who I've never met reads me your text. And then she asks me, you know, do you want to save it, dump it, answer? Okay, I'll answer it. Everything's by speech. I answer the text. Then you call me back because you got the answer. I'm still driving. I park the car while we're still talking. I turn off the engine and I pick up my device. And we continue the conversation as I walk to the office where I'm going to speak with you for the meeting we're just about to have. All right. How many people have done something like that? Most of you, please? I hope so. You have cars in Sweden, right? So when you do it, do you just want to jump for joy? I do, man. I get out of the car and I'm just saying, holy crap, what just happened? This is a bloody miracle. Think about it for a minute. First off, remember, that's not a car, that's a $10,000 computer. If you have a $30,000 car, well, it's not $30,000, I'm exaggerating, just pretend I'm rich. If you have a $30,000 car, you have a $10,000 computer. One third of the cost of a modern car is in the information systems. So I have two computers, this computer and that computer, both cleverly disguised as a phone and a car. When I get into the car and I put the phone on the passenger seat and I start going, where is the phone? Did you in the car? Wrong. Where is the phone? Okay, it is the car and the phone. It's a bogus question. Listen, when an academic asks you a question, there's only one answer you can always get that's right. It depends. And in this case, if the car and the phone have been introduced, which is human language for the cyber babble of Bluetooth paired, if it's been introduced, they seamlessly integrate together into a single thing where you cannot separate them. The car and the phone, in the sort of Buddhist kind of way, become one. You cannot separate them. Think about it. The speech, the microphones, the speaker, the speech understanding, the address book are all in the car. Only 5 or 10% of that handset are being used during that whole transaction when they're paired. The Bluetooth chip, the SIM chip, the battery, and a little bit of logic. Everything else is in the vehicle. You cannot separate it. So the real answers, other than it depends, are bogus question, yes, everywhere, or my favorite is, it's not about the phone. It's about the communication. Put it in human terms. With me, you can always just put the human terms. Now, if we do that, it becomes really interesting. Because here's why I leap for joy, and after you've grokked what I'm saying, you're going to start, every day you get out of the car, you're going to say, jump for joy when this thing works, because it works. And you notice that when you get out of the car and you're having this conversation, what just happened? 90% of the technology managing the call locally just changed. But even more than that, 100% of the interaction language changed. You're no longer, when you're driving the car, using the touch screen, which is eyes on, and the touch is fingers on, which we call modern. If you're using your eyes and your fingers on the phone while you're driving, you should lose your driver's license, because the wannabe Boreas Salmings are out playing road hockey, and they're probably your kid, and you don't want them to be killed by somebody who's texting or phoning or looking at their phone when they're driving. So when you get out of the car, you've got this 90% change in hardware managing the call locally. You've got 100% change in interaction language. And because of those two huge inconsistencies, you have 100% consistency of conversation. And the two things, after having beautifully aggregated, they gracefully disaggregate and take on their own lives and morph into a different persona, so to speak. And that is a bloody miracle. It's one of the few places I want you to actually pay attention as you go around and see how rarely You see that type of aggregation and disaggregation and things working together. But the neat thing is, it's been doing that for years. This isn't a 2007 car, this is a 2010, and it's been, that was well on the way when this type of capability was about. Everything should work like that. Just like the connected graph, social graph that I showed when I had the Microsoft ecosystem of hardware on the screen. So let's see what this means if we translate this into a little bit more, not very technical, a description. But at the technological level, you've got something going on here that relates to the functionality, what the user sees, the engineer's view and the user's view. First of all, you can assume that when I aggregate two technologies, I'm going to augment some of the capability. So aggregation of technologies, augmentation of capability. That seems to make sense. And it also seems intuitive that as I split things apart, that I get some degradation of capability as I, like my speech in the car, the speech recognition services are not as good when I pull the phone away than, at least currently, when I pull the phone away from the car as when they're together. So with the disaggregation, you get this degradation, but it's graceful. But what's less intuitive is that when I aggregate, sometimes you also get you probably get more degradation when you aggregate, then you get augmentation. And you get, as I disaggregate, I get more augmentation. Now that seems a little less intuitive, but let me give you an example. Yes, when I aggregate, I augment the overall speech capabilities. But I also remove your ability to play Angry Birds, to do an Excel spreadsheet, to check your email and browse and flip through the web pages and so on. That's interesting, right? Probably 80% or 90% of the things you do in your phone, you can no longer do. And you never miss it because it's inappropriate. If you're doing those things when you're driving your car, you should lose your driver's license. It violates, again in sociology speak, it violates the social mores or the moral order of the place, of the context. And so instead of having everything everywhere all the time, and just as we add more technologies, we just gang up all the capabilities and give you more and more choices, if we like the supermarket door, we know you're at a supermarket, not a bank, so the door's going to open, and I will give you the right thing at the right place at the right time. And when I do so, what's critical to understand is the quality of the transitions. It's all about not can I do it here versus there. It's the question, as I get out of the car and I pick up the phone, as I'm getting out, I have to go, okay, change modes. Okay, now I got to go to systems, I got to go to settings and change that. Okay, now it's a standalone phone instead of all that. It just happens. And designing the transitions, and anybody who's worked with PERT charts or these flow diagrams to map out project management, or if you're designing a user interface and you've got so-called storyboards where you've got the screenshots connected by arrows, if you don't have as much detail in the arrows as you have in the screenshots, you've already lost the game. And the transitions have to take into account the transitions are the same thing as how do I gracefully approach you? What's your personal space? When do I violate your personal space? When do you know me? How do you establish that we know each other? Do I have a name badge? That's how you'd have it today. I'm too far away to see your name. If I come closer, I'll be able to greet you by name, right? Pull away. How do all those things work? Those are all the social graces we have to give to our technologies in a way that's reliable, predictable, and secure. And they have to be seamless and graceful. So we can come down and talk about this a bit more. Here's this guy. He just got off the plane. I'll tell you where the story came from. It came from, I was coming down from Cambridge, England, to King's Cross Station, and I was going to meet a professor friend of mine at the University College London. Now, it's a walkable distance, but every time I come out of King's Cross Station, there's so much construction, I never can find the exit, much less, and then you're trying to walk to University College London, it's like a rabbit's warren. And so I'm sitting there like this guy, this jerk. And you've got off a plane, you've got off a train, you've got off the tube, and there's someone in front of you going like this. And they can't see the beauty of St. Pancras Station as they walk past it. You want to talk to them, but you can't talk to them because they're totally concentrating here. If you're in England, you go to cross the street, you're going to get killed because you're looking the wrong way and the cars drive on the wrong side. By the way, if you want to prove that societies can change, some of you are old enough to remember when in Sweden you used to drive on that side of the road as well. And you just made up your minds, bam, we're going to change. See, we can do that about how we design this kind of technology as well. You've already done it. Sweden's a leader in that. So here we go. What do we know about this? Do you know this guy? Everybody knows this guy? All right, put up your hands if you like this guy. You like that guy? Are you crazy? Okay, there's sociopaths everywhere, right? So, that's really, really, really unfair, because the fact is that everything's best for something and worse for something else. I'm speaking in broad generalities, and no human subjects were injured in this experiment. Are you this guy? Every one of us has been this guy. So, that gets us somewhere. This is the key part, because this affects you as much as it affects us. Do you like whatever makes you be that person? Do you have any brand loyalty to the companies who make the technology that cause you to be that guy? Now, I understand you. We all do it, and the reason we do it is we have no other option. The only other option is to pull out a paper map and look even like more of a jerk. This one's more dangerous, though, because if you're in some places in North America, and probably in Naples, walking around with your expensive phone is sort of like saying, hey, I'm a tourist, come and steal my phone. Somebody in a scooter is going to come right by, jump off, grab it, hop in the scooter, and off you go. But you can't look cool, you know, even if you're not going to get robbed. Nobody feels good about that. They're good about getting to where they want to go. That's the value proposition. But the cost, let's put it this way. If somebody came up with a way that would enable you to get to where you wanted to go without having to hold the phone in your hand, so you could just walk around, look at the architecture, enjoy the fresh air, be able to hold a conversation with a friend, not get killed by a car, not step on things dogs have left on the sidewalk, all that sort of stuff, you would change technologies instantly. And you would have no loyalty or brand tie-in or responsibilities whatsoever. So I have this rule. The rule is this. If you can see a way to shoot yourself in the foot, you are crazy if you don't think your competition can also see it. And so the thing you have to do is make the hard decision to say, if I'm going to lose my toes anyhow, so if somebody's going to pull the trigger, it should be me, then I can choose which toes I can live without and when I can live without them, even if it means hurting your primary source of revenue, cannibalizing your revenue stream, because you're going to lose that toe or that foot. And so let's do it before it becomes a crisis. Because here's the thing, this isn't natural. And there is nothing that you can do on that device to change it. If you think about only a single device, this phone, coupled to the cloud, yes, 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 if you only have this, there's nothing you can do in the software or on the hardware itself that I can imagine will get you out of this situation. And that's where the kind of complexities and these social, it's not just the technological complexities, it's technology, the complexities of just functioning in the world, that's what I'm talking about in terms of the society of technologies. So what happens here is let's fix it and not be that person, and let's be the guy still in this photograph, just a different photograph. And this isn't real, this is just me brainstorming with my team. So the guy's here. So what happens here? Get out of the tube, The GPS works, all that stuff. So I don't want to get rid of this. I just want to say, okay, here's where I want to go. Just look at my calendar where I'm going to go. I want to get there. Tell me how to get there. Figure out the GPS, figure out where I am, that's all. Just. And then I put the phone back in my pocket. And I just walk out. And so what I realize is, around the train station, all around there, there's advertisements everywhere on the wall. All these advertisers are trying to get my eyeballs on this, on their ads. And certainly, I'm not going to have my eyeballs on their ads because my eyes are down here. So we're going to form a partnership. So what happens is, phone just says, okay, look on the upper left-hand corner of the ads. And on one of the ads in your field of view, as you walk along, you will see a blinking red dot. Walk to the dot. And when you get by the dot, it's going to sense you there. And it's going to do a little gesture and tell you what direction, just to say that way or that way, a little flick. And so I go that way and start looking for the next dot. Now, what you have to do is you have to be looking at all the ads as you're walking around. Nobody can tell that's what I'm doing. You can't tell which person of those two men, which is the guy, it happens, there's the dot, there's the guy. Nobody can tell. It's transparent. The technology disappears. And I can walk from point A to point B, and away I go. Now, this is pretty neat, in a way, conceptually. And I'm not suggesting you do what I'm describing. I'm suggesting this is a plausible solution. And the point that's important is not that this is a good or even the right answer, but rather to say it is probable that any solution that we want to cause to improve on where we are today needs to be as different from what we're doing today as this is. It's this range of differences. It's the scale of the differences. And then if you analyze that difference, you notice that it's not just incremental change on the phone. It means that the partners we need to engage in going forward are totally, not totally, but very largely different from the partners that got us where we are. And so the people we've worked with, our history, where we're comfortable with, that got us where we are, aren't necessarily who we need as our partners as we go forward. It doesn't mean dump our old partners, it just means we need to engage other partners and see how well. But you need the right team. And you look at this and start to say, how do you get there? Well, just think about it. The advertisers are the ones who pay the bills for all this free stuff we get. And I'd far rather not have ads popping up on my phone, but having my head popping up at the ads that are already there and still be able to enjoy the environment because it's far less disruptive. And I'm getting a service. So we can come down this kind of path. But I'll give you another example of how we can make this kind of thing work. This is Kirsty. So I've been working with Kirsty with a group group in Reading, England. We've been doing these studies in Reading. Largely a lot of us are from Microsoft Research. This is actually a project that Satya initiated. So Kirsty is blind, totally blind. And I have to tell you a little bit about blind people, because this is exactly the same app that we just talked about. Just different actor, different costume, different props. In the United Kingdom, 65% of people who are totally blind never, ever leave home alone. So you've got 35% who are what we call independent travelers. And if you are an independent traveler, one of the 35, you probably know only about 8 routes. Now, to learn a route, you have to memorize it. And you have a trained professional that costs as much as a music teacher for private music lessons to teach you the route. You will have typically 2 2-hour training sessions a week for up to 12 weeks. Some people are faster, depends on your experience, how long, and so on and so forth. There's individual differences. But let's pretend it's only 2 months. That's 8 weeks, that's 16 2-hour lessons, it's 32 hours. Before you can take that route on your own. And when I say on your own, that means either with a dog or with a cane. So we wanted to see what we could do. So we worked with the guide dogs organization in the United Kingdom. And the guide dogs also work with people who have canes, use the white cane. And you'll notice on her head, she has this headset. And so this is a Bluetooth headset. We just modified for the prototypes. It's an Aftershocks. It's a bone conduction headset that just comes around. And you notice it doesn't cover the ear because your ears are your eyes if you're blind. You need your ears clear to hear traffic and all these other things. And we built some circuitry in the back. So we glued on or screwed on this little box in the back of the headset that has an IMU. So it's just got the 9-degree freedom accelerometer, compass, gyro. And it's connected wirelessly to your mobile phone, which stays in your pocket or your purse or your briefcase or whatever. Now, I think most people have had something like the Pink Floyd or something like that. You put on the headphones and you're listening to music and it's spatial and it's just like totally 60s, man. And it's a great, wonderful spatial audio experience. But I have to tell you, all the sound localization is happening inside the head between the ears. Now, through the when virtual reality first started coming out, and this is about 30 years ago, from NASA and JPL and Air Force and DARPA funded a whole bunch of the work, they started to develop ways that you could put sounds outside your head. And this is just virtual reality. Actually, it's augmented reality if you can hear the world as well, where the sounds are out in space and they sound as real as the visual images you get with VR screens. Just think of it's an acoustic, a 3D AR acoustic display instead of visual display. And so these things are called head-related transfer functions, and you do the math, you measure the head. For example, you may not know this, but if a sound is directly in front of you or directly behind it, you cannot tell unless you turn your head. And you have these ears, and you know from basic physics in high school that a wave can't bend around an obstacle that's more than wider than the wavelength of the wave. And so then those are high frequencies. So the thing is, when you turn your head, I can tell if the sound's behind me because I hear more high frequencies as I get through my right ear as I turn this way and fewer there, or vice versa if I turn my head. So head turning's critical. It has to be really fast, and your ears work. And if you're Prince Charles, you have really good spatial hearing because it's lower down in the frequency spectrum where the cutoff filter is. And some of us, anyhow, so there you have it. So it's subtle. So this is the thing. So now we don't use, like your car, turn left, stop, go to the next corner, walk 25 feet. No. Actually, I got yelled at because I suggested the way to describe what we do is it's like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, where you just follow the piper and with this non-speech audio. And they said, Bill, he was leading them to their death. So bad branding, bad example. But the thing here is that there's a non-speech thing. It's sort of like a horse is like out in front of you, and you can just follow that. Now, if you're coming to a critical place, it will give you some instructions, but minimal speech intervention. If you ask, it'll tell you what's around you. You can even ask, where's the nearest coffee shop? What is it? Take me there. You can do all those types of things with just using speech. A little dongle here to operate. You know how you have that little few buttons on the steering column of your car to augment the speech? Same thing here. Just phone stays in the pocket. So, very discreet, it works, and you can navigate. So here's the kicker. For the first time, even in the first year, we're in the third year of the project now, I, who am not blind, you might have noticed, I'm dumb, but I'm not blind, but what you can do within 5 minutes of using a cane, which I'd never used before, totally blindfolded on a street I'd never been on before, I was able to walk independently without a dog, without anybody helping me. I could just follow a path, and all the journalists we did could do the same thing. And furthermore, within about 5 minutes, I could also hold a conversation while I'm doing so. That means there's no cognitive interference. It means there's very low cognitive load. I'm using existing skills. And because you process non-speech audio in a different place of your brain than you process spoken language, there's no interference at the cognitive level. And because you have things coming from different locations, there's even less because your brain separates this stuff. So this is kind of cool. And it works. And unless you look carefully, especially if Kirstie had the headset under her hair instead of on, you wouldn't hardly notice that she was blind except for the cane. There's no added burden. So this is all nice. So I've given you an example where by adding more technology in the right place to the right person in the right form, you can actually reduce complexity and greatly increase value. Now, this is all fine, but I have to put in another plug for another thing that I think is critical to think about. And that's called universal design. And universal design says that when we are designing for the general population, we need to consider solutions which will allow accessibility for those who are not in the larger population, people who are sight impaired or hearing impaired, or motor, in terms of their motor skills are impaired. And the critical thing about universal design is that it turns out that if you go off into the extremes, and I'm telling you this story, I'm not being some bleeding heart saying, well, think about the poor people who need your help. No, I'm saying this is just, in your own selfish interest, a really good strategy to come up with answers and solutions you wouldn't come to otherwise. But if we do it this way, here's what happens. If you go to the extreme and you find a solution that works in the extreme, in almost every case, it's a different solution than you would have got had you stayed with the mainstream. And by going to the extreme, that solution will apply to the mainstream as well as the extreme. So let me give you an example. Why don't you use the touchscreen and the icons when you're driving your car? Because when you, every one of us, is driving a car, we are in fact totally blind with respect to operating the phone. Because our eyes are otherwise occupied. And if your eyes are otherwise occupied here, you are blind there. But I'll even go further. Instead of being Kirsty walking around blind in London, I'm going to take you to Beijing. I'm going to take you to Greece. I'm going to take you to the Arabic world, a place where the street signs and everything is in a script that I suspect the majority of us do not know how to read. And guess what? You are blind about knowing how to get from point A to point B. The map you've got, everything's printed out in Roman, you know, the letters that you understand. And you look at the signs and see you cannot even correlate one to the other. So you can actually walk around a city, and if you do know the way and you don't want to read the street signs, you can just get where you're going, talk to your family, and when you're a tourist. And by the way, when you're not doing that, you can listen to music. Or you can take phone calls. And all I'm saying is, we are all blind some of the time. And if you think about where the situations that you have solutions that let you do this. So you can actually take this and you could use it for, let's say, example, just, hey, Cortana, where's this? Where do I have to be? When do I have to, how much time do I have? Whatever. All that becomes available and you don't have to have these other, you don't need any additional stuff. It's the same headset. So I'm just saying, this is not a product. This is a research thing. We're really working on the population here. But I'm trying to just make a point by a very specific example that I can draw on some experience that's understandable, that by adding more of the right technology in the right place in the right time, you can reduce complexity and greatly increase value and at the same time open up new possibilities that come down. And if there's smoke, there's fire. This is the smoke. There are, in almost every sphere of where digital technology is being applied, there are opportunities like this that you can take. So this brings us back to Ubiidy. I told you I was going to get back to it. Ubiidy is the close cousin of ubiquity. I want you to remember this term. I want you to start using this term. I want you to preach this term, because I believe that it is fundamental. And if you need a key example just to explain it, use the supermarket door. Get the groceries from the back, from the counter to the car. And if your arms are full, you're pushing a cart, you can't open the door, so the door opens for you. And it knows it's the supermarket, and it knows you're exiting, and it knows your arms are there. Not because it's smart, but because the person who put it there is smart. And so you wait for general machine intelligence. Use our own intelligence to take advantage of place. So Ubiidy is this thing that says that it's not so much everything, everywhere, all the time for everybody. That's more ubiquity. It's the right thing in the right place, at the right time, at the right price, in the right form, with the right capability. And the operative word is place. When you say Ubiidy, it's place. And when you say place, it doesn't just mean in geography or your GPS point, it's social place, it's social relative place in terms of distance, it's hierarchy, it's all these other things. Think of every definition of place, write them down, and then when you're making solutions, think about how can I exploit a knowledge of place, and then how can I detect the sense of place, and how can I fold that into my design so that, like the phone when it leaves the car, the behavior can change automatically and adapt to the new environment in a way which is seamless, graceful, and brings delight and is appropriate, and the quality of ubiquity remains with the same type of transition that brings the same smile to every transaction that I get when I get out of the car and remove my phone and decouple it. And I've given these examples about how we can do this. Now, there's an architect, Louis Kahn, who I think has... He's one of my heroes. If you're ever in San Diego, go visit the Salk Center. But it's just a beautiful, beautiful building. That's where that photograph is taken here. But he has this great line. He says, thoughts exchanged by one and another are not the same in one room as in another. Its meaning is hugely influenced by context, social place, physical place, and all these things. And that includes the meaning of our technologies and how they work together. And it's not just about between me and the phone, it's between each other. When Satya says cloud first, mobile first, it's an interesting thing. How many of you sort of, when he said that the first time you heard that, said, how can two things be first? And cloud and mobile? So here's what happened. It's really interesting. This is a true story. So I sent him a note. I said, Satya, I understand what you're saying. And furthermore, I really, really, really agree with it. But when you say that, people are going to wonder, how can two things be first? But the second thing is, when you say mobile, they're going to think this. And here's what I suggest. Every time you say that, add the following phrase. Cloud first, mobile first. But when I say mobility, I mean the mobility of the human activity, supported by technology, one of which might be your mobile phone, but it could be all these other embedded things. And when we talk about a mobile-first world, supported by the cloud, and those things working together, now they can both be first. The mobility is about the human activity, not about the technology. And what's critical about that, and it's clear in the examples I've given you, that it is all about the mobility of the person. The guy walking out of the train to get to UCL. Me, or Kirsty in this case, being able to get from here to there and having things adapt. And what's really interesting is that in the car example, the technology that supports the mobility, part of the time is a personal device. It could be a wearable, it could be a pocketable, it might even be an implant, working in concert with something that's embedded in the environment. Remember, your car is a computer, and it is the biggest manifestation of ambient intelligence that I can think of in sensor networks, but it's like the environment. And so as I traverse through my activities, that the technology adapts, just like we had before. And these are really critical things that come down to this notion of not just any place here in one room is another, but furthermore, how I talk about them are going to change when I walk out of the dining room into the bar. And so here we go. We could finish up. If you're driving a car and you're using your phone as a phone, that might be your kid out front. You should lose your driver's license. So you should be on the left screen. You should be using speech. And if you're not, you should lose your job. You should lose your driver's license. Now, that woman works for Microsoft. The guy beside her obviously works for, I don't know, SAP, I don't know. Apple, yeah, right. If she's landing at San Jose Airport and calling Satya to tell him the most important business secret that's going to cause Microsoft stock to go up $20, and she does use speech, she should lose her job. What I'm trying to say is it's not about the technology. No matter how good the speech is, she should not be using speech for that confidential message because she's flying to San Jose and she has no idea who's around. It violates this moral order. This person on the left, no matter how bad the speech is, he should be using speech, or he should lose his driver's license. It's all about context. That is ubiquity personified in those two images. And furthermore, they could be holding the same conversation, moving from the car across and into the plane, and the whole modalities have to change. So I'm going to wrap up now, finish. I want to give you an exercise of imagination, because we all want to disrupt. Everybody knows about disruptive technologies. We all want the next big something or other. Well, let's imagine that. Okay. What if things just worked? What if things just worked together? What if things just worked together seamlessly? And what if they, in so doing, you got an overall reduction in complexity? And what if in so doing, you got an overall reduction in value, or increase in value? Is there anything that you can imagine would have more impact on our industry and have more longevity if we just went through that exercise and we've got to that imagined world? An imagined world where I've given you examples where it's deliverable today in part, and where there is a roadmap where we could incrementally, collectively, you working with us, to bring us faster as fast as possible to where we've got that everywhere. We don't have to get there. Think of office. You don't have to get it in the first build. You need to be ambitious, but you have to be realistic. How do you go together? Our society of partners, with our society of technologies in this larger ecosystem, if we go on that path, nothing can stop us. And the end result will be something that we can all be incredibly proud of. So this is a friend of mine, Marco Prejelic. He's one of the top mountaineers in the world. I am not in his league. He's striving for something. He takes risk. He also takes incredible photographs. But he's an example of what I say here. Now that we could do everything and anything, what should we do? And achieving the goal that I'm saying, I think, is one of the things that I think that's what we should be doing, and we can do it. And with that, I say thank you very much, and I hope the rest of this day is fantastic for you. Thank you.